Hello and welcome to This Week in Wealth, your still somewhat brand new podcast from Citywire RAA. I'm Alex Steger, and as ever, I'm joined by Citywire RAA editor Ian Wenick. Hi, Ian.
You can't see it if you're listening, obviously, but I'm doing a big cheesy grin with two thumbs up. I'm very excited to be here today, as usual.
That is true. He is doing that, still doing it. And we're also joined today for her pod debut, although a lot of people will be making their debut in the next few weeks. But we are joined today by RAA reporter Lily Riddle. Hi, Lily.
Hi, happy to be here.
Very happy to have you here. Now, as ever, the aim of the game here is to talk about some of the biggest stories of the last week and offer a little bit more than just what we've written. So I think one of the big stories, Ian, that we wrote right at the start of this actually shortened week was that of Envestnet getting a new CEO. So what happened? And then I've got quite a few follow-ups on what's going on with Envestnet, because I think it's safe to say it's been a choppy couple of years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I keep thinking back to when I was pledging my fraternity, you had to recite the whole Greek alphabet from memory. And I feel the similar way with recounting all the things that have happened to this company in the past 5 years. But the newest development is that...
Just to be clear, at the end of this, we're not going to like make you do some weird hazing challenge or anything. So you can put your fraternity flashbacks to one side. But yeah, the latest development...
They have a new CEO, a new permanent CEO after almost a calendar year of searching.
Okay, fantastic. Who is he?
They have hired Chris Todd, who was formerly the CEO of UKG, which was a large human resources software company. So they've hired a true industry outsider as opposed to insider to run the show.
Fantastic. And we're going to come on in a minute to sort of what's in his... People will use this phrase still, what's in his in-tray, like anyone has an in-tray anymore. But yeah, we're going to sort of come on to what his priorities and agenda are going to need to be. But before we look forwards, let's look backwards a moment. So you already alluded to it took them a year to find this CEO. And prior to that, the CEO was an interim anyway, or was he a permanent CEO?
So they have had basically two chief executives in the last year. So the current interim CEO was James Fox, who was the chair of the company's board of directors. And then before that was Bill Crager, who left as the permanent CEO at the end of Q1 2024.
Crager was a founder of the firm, but he took over as CEO in obviously difficult circumstances.
Yes, so Bill was elevated to the CEO job in tragic circumstances in 2019 when Judd Bergman, one of the company's founders, him and his wife were killed in an accident with a wrong-way driver on the way to the San Francisco airport. And Bill was elevated into the CEO position first on an interim emergency basis, and then they took the interim tag off, and he had served as CEO for roughly 5 years, so give or take a couple months, before he exited in 24.
And not necessarily the easiest of 5 years. Quite a lot went on with the company during that time. So this is your Greek alphabet time, I suppose, starting from approximately then. What were some of the major headlines and indeed headaches that Envestnet faced over that time?
So there was a failed attempt to sell the company, which we reported on extensively in 2022.
So it was a public company at the time?
Yes. There was a near proxy fight with an activist investor that had accumulated a sizable share in the company, about 8.5%.
And I seem to remember the activists, obviously all activists, investors who go about these kind of campaigns have some quite sort of pointed letters that they very accidentally on purpose make public. And I seem to remember theirs had some quite sharp remarks around the performance of the share price.
Yes, they criticized the performance of the share price, which did really underperform the S&P 500 over the last couple of years. Criticized management pay, spending on acquisitions. I mean, they really kind of raked management over the coals, and they did get a board seat eventually, and they signed a cooperation letter in the end.
Okay, so back to the Greek alphabet, or the timeline in this situation. So failed sale process, activist investor making some noise and pointed criticism about the firm. What else was going on?
Then we have, I mean, look, I think I destroyed the Envestnet PR hotline's inbox, because we wrote about a ton of long-term, well-established executives leaving the company, from Stuart DePina, the president, to Ron Ransom, who was a big strategy executive. They changed out CFO. So there was pretty much wholesale turnover in the C-suite over the last 2 to 3 years.
Okay. And then this culminated, or culminated is the wrong word, but things maybe got a little bit calmer when there was indeed a take private sale.
Yes. They sold, they finally reached a take private agreement in 24 over the summer to a consortium of investors led by Bain Capital, Reverence Capital Partners, another prominent PE firm that has lots of wealth investments. They were a participating investor, and then several asset managers also participated in the take private.
Okay, and then so since then, less news? Well, there's still been a certain amount of sort of rockiness, shall we say, including even this year.
Yes, so earlier in the year, we wrote about the company, a startup that they backed, Advisor Credit Exchange.
Which did what exactly?
So that was basically a clearinghouse for advisors to connect clients with lending options. And so that is shutting down at the end of the month, which is something that we broke. And they basically invested in a VC firm, and one of their executives teamed up. They all co-invested in it. And they built a lending platform for InvestNet. And now ACX is shutting down.
Okay, and then that lending platform will no longer be
yes,
on.
Yes, InvestNet for off-platform solutions, which is what a spokesperson for the company told us.
Okay, got it. But then our man Todd is in, so this could herald a new dawn for the company, or is there still, as I think there is, quite a lot for him to have to deal with?
I mean, there is a lot to deal with. I mean, I think the thing that's first top of mind is the fate of Yodlee, which is a data analytics business that has basically been sort of an Achilles heel for the company for a long time now. So back when Judd was still running the company, they bought Yodlee, and the company's stock price plunged by 20% in a single day. The street hated that transaction. And if you actually look...
Because they overpaid? Because what they bought wasn't that good? What was the...
So there was a couple of different factors. I think one was the price. The other was profitability of certain Yodlee business lines. And so as I did some research following the take private deal, in the proxy statement around the transaction, there were some offers for InvestNet's business that were higher than the ultimate Bain offer they accepted. But the issue is that they were contingent on InvestNet selling Yodlee through a separate transaction process. And InvestNet ultimately chose the Bain transaction because it did not require a sale of Yodlee as a contingency and had the easiest, quickest path towards close. And so Chris, one of his first tasks is going to be to figure out, what the heck am I going to do with this thing? Is there something I can save out of it? Am I going to have to sell it? What am I going to do? And it's a lot easier to make those decisions in the 4 to 7 year PE hold period versus as a public company. See, like I'm repeating myself from last week, get answering analyst questions about what are you going to do? What are you going to do every 3 months?
Got it. Okay. So that's one thing that's top of his list. Is there anything else that springs to your mind that he's going to have to sort of need to think about, need to deal with?
I mean, I think the question is, you know, this happens with a lot of PE firms, is are there other kinds of areas of cost cuts, areas of where you can find synergies? And sometimes layoffs are a part of that. And so before Chris left UKG, he had a difficult task of laying off, I believe, about 2,000 employees, about 14% of the workforce. I might be off a little bit on those numbers, so don't quote me directly on it. But is that UKG?
I mean, we're literally quoting, yeah. But it's fine. We've a valid disclaimer there, listener, so don't jump out of your skin.
And I talked about it directly with Chris. We did one of the first interviews with him, and he said, yeah, that was an incredibly difficult decision, but he thinks that the investment thesis underlying Bain's decision to take InvestNet private is a little bit different. And I think that there's a lot of validity to that because InvestNet owns and makes a lot of very popular products. They have the MoneyGuide suite of financial planning software, which has massive market share. They have Tamarac, the trading software. They have their massive investment outsourcing platform. There's a lot of products that InvestNet provides that are really useful and relevant to advisors. And it's going to be his task to figure out how to maintain that quality while finding ways to cut costs and maybe selling off poor performers like a Yodlee.
I was going to say, it is important. We sort of focused on the sort of, I suppose, choppier times and some of the more negative headlines that have come out about the firm in the last few years. But look, yeah, underlying this is an incredibly popular company, hugely widely used by thousands and thousands and thousands of financial advisors. So which makes it both really important to the sort of, particularly the RIA community, But yeah, it's by no means a sort of, you know, a terrible thing.
And I mean, so much of what we're talking about that's happened to this company, it was all precipitated by an exogenous shock to the company. And I think all that's happened the last couple of years has to be viewed in light of that fact.
Got it. Anything else interesting that he told you when you spoke to him?
Yeah, I mean, he said he wanted to visit all the company's offices, including the location they have out in India. So he'll be racking up the miles.
Got it. And it shut down it did shut down some offices, though, didn't it?
They did shut a couple down.
Okay, fantastic. Well, interesting times for InvestNet. Thank you, Ian. Now, Lily, you're here not to talk about InvestNet.
No.
You're here to talk about, I don't know if we could call it the most important story that we wrote this week, but we will see at the end of the week whether it was the most read story. We know it certainly got traction. So I think I've churred it enough. Tell us what this hot scoop is.
I am here to talk about the hit ABC reality dating show, The Bachelor, on which one of the staffers, a client service associate at a $2 billion firm, Winthrop Wealth Management, will be a contestant on the upcoming season. So very exciting, not as maybe Greek alphabet-esque as the InvestNet saga, but still fun nonetheless. And so I'll look forward to watching her on the show.
Okay, so I have questions both about the story and about the show.
Yes.
Spoiler alert, I'm not as familiar as some people will be with it. But first, I can say this is not the first time we have had an RAA or RAA adjacent person on a hit show. Correct, Ian?
That's correct. I mean, I was very excited when Zachary Schreier, who was an advisor at an LPL affiliated practice he ran, he had a nice little run on Jeopardy back in 2021.
And I lest we forget, and the fugitive advisor Chris Burns also appeared on America's Most Wanted. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So there you go. She's in illustrious company. Tell us a little bit more then. Okay. So if we could assume for a moment I'm an idiot and I haven't really watched The Bachelor.
Yes. No, you're not an idiot, but assuming you haven't watched
it. Yes, I haven't watched The Bachelor. What's she been doing then?
So once you're cast, she will join the company of a few dozen other women. Typically, it's about 30. Who will compete for the affection of The Bachelor, or in the case of its spinoff series, The Bachelorette, who in this case is Grant Ellis, who is a 30-year-old day trader from Newark, who currently lives in Houston.
Maybe there could be like a beautiful plot twist, like if she won, she could take this day trader and give him some sensible financial advice. Stop day trading.
Yeah.
Get in some index funds, fella. Sit there, don't touch it, and in 30 years' time, by the miracle of compounding, you'll have more money. Just.
Although The Bachelor actually gets paid a rather hefty salary,
he's never gonna need it more. This is perfect.
So she'll join other women, and every week the field is narrowed down until by the end of the show's filming, which was announced from the chief operating officer on LinkedIn that it had already wrapped and that she's already returned to the firm. But after filming, the chosen woman will, in theory, get proposed to, and then they will hide out while the show airs. And then, by the end of it, they will go public with their love and all will be well, or not, because most of the time they break up.
Obviously, because they met on a reality show. Yeah, that makes complete sense. Quick question, and again, excuse my ignorance for the mechanics of The Bachelor. If she's back at work and not hiding out somewhere, I don't want to ruin the show for anyone. And well, we're obviously now all incredibly invested in her fortunes in it. But does this perhaps suggest that she didn't win?
It is possible that she made it somewhat far, but yes, this points to her elimination, unfortunately, because my understanding is that most of the time filming has not completely wrapped up by the time the show airs or premieres, like the time, you know, season premiere. So yes, unfortunately for any, you know, Bachelor fans, any Juliana fans, not sure Grant chose her.
But we don't know.
I could be wrong.
Could be a double bluff. Fantastic. Well, as I say, arguably not the most consequential story for the wider RIA world, but I think we've heard both anecdotally and looking at our stats that it is the one that people like, because it turns out our readers are frivolous. Ian.
So I was obviously all my sources are confidential, but I received a text from a source about Julia Pascarosa is the contestant's name. I received a text that said simply, she's not going to be a client service associate for long. And attached to that text message was a picture of four women in his office, all crowded around one screen, reading Lily's story. And look, you know, she might not win, but I refer to the thing as the reality industrial complex, which is that even if she doesn't win, there's still Bachelor in Paradise.
Oh, absolutely.
And if she's big enough, The Traitors is definitely on the table too.
And look, I personally believe if she got together with this Bachelor, we could produce an excellent and indeed I'm sure riveting show about her helping him build a financial plan. So spin-offs are plenty. Before we go, very quickly, Ian, it wouldn't be an episode of This Week in Wealth without us talking at least about one big deal. So what have you got to end us?
Yeah, so that doesn't really narrow it down a lot, right? So maybe I'll start with the one that's the freshest in the chamber, and that is we broke on Thursday, the day before this episode airs, that Focus Financial Partners, who we just talked about last week.
The focus, indeed, of last week's episode.
Yes, yeah. They were, the literal focus. They're raising about $500 million in debt to fund an $816 million payout to their shareholders, which includes their private equity owners, CD&R, Clayton, DeBillier & Rice, and Stone Point Capital, along with the management of the company and a lot of the advisors and executives at their top affiliates. So if they're doing a dividend recap like this early into the hold period, because CD&R took them private in 2023, it's a sign that CD&R is confident in the health of the business and the progress that they've made if they're willing to add additional debt onto the company's balance sheet now to fund a payout like this.
I was going to say, so a dividend recap, as it's known,
yes,
can be seen sort of a few different ways. Obviously, it does add debt to the company, and obviously it does pay out the shareholders, perhaps earlier than them having to, you know, sell the company or do an IPO or what have you. But it all does also speak to the health of you couldn't do it if things weren't going well.
You don't layer on this debt if you're not confident in the ability of this business to generate free cash flow. And if there's one thing that RIAs are good at, besides generating headlines, it's generating free cash flow.
Fantastic. Well, look, you can read all three of those stories on CityWire RIA. This has been This Week in Wealth. And Ian, thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me. And please, subscribe, Spotify, or on every major podcast platform. Subscribe, rate us 5 stars. Just keep on listening.
There you go. There's the plug. And Lily, you don't have to plug, but thank you as well for having. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, of course. And everything Ian said.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, listener. And we will be back next week.